this is Charlie, and you are listening to Minor Recs. Today I'm joined by Joel and Michelle and Ariana, and today we will be talking about art. In some senses, we sort of talk about art every time, because I don't know about you, I've got a pretty expansive definition of what art is. I think books are art, films are art, music is art. It's not just pretty pictures in a museum. So I'd say most of what we have here at the library can be considered art in some way. The building's always full of art, whether it's the actual materials that we have or the exhibits that we have. I know that because our summer reading club theme this year is reading is artrageous, we have quite a few art-themed programs and exhibits here in the library and online as well. So we'll all be talking about some art that you can either find here at the library or that you can learn more about, that you can experience. Joel, would you like to start us off?
Oh, sure. I recently encountered a documentary on our streaming app, Canopy, that you can sign up using your library card. It is a movie made, I believe, the exhibit happened in 2010, but it's a documentary about the exhibit of Marina Abramović, The Artist Is Present, which showed at the New York City Museum of Modern Art. It's an incredible documentary about Abramović and her commitment to the style of art, of performance art. You know, it's not photography or anything visual. It's just, it's a new sense. It's not even, you know, it blends all senses together. And it's all about the experience and the feeling of that experience. She's had a long history of decades of performance art, and she always pushes it to the limit, to the edge. She started out carving things under her skin and representing the pain. She also had an exhibit where she just laid down and screamed a lot, and basically you join in the moment of screaming. And she had other exhibits where she and a partner would literally run into each other. The thing to mention, though, that to take away the layers that might separate the viewer and the performer, she would often do this unclothed, so in the nude. And in this particular case, she and her partner would be running together, they'd be jogging towards each other, and they would literally collide just to kind of represent sometimes the conflict that might happen in a relationship. So this is all incorporated into this documentary, but that's like basically the backstory. She's always been the like avant-garde, pushing the idea of performance art, and it culminates in this Museum of Modern Art exhibit where she takes all of the different stages of her career and represents them with other models who are doing the things that she has done, I think maybe minus that cutting part at the beginning. But the ultimate pinnacle of the piece is of her sitting in a chair. Across the table is an empty chair. And people who view the exhibit can sit down in that extra chair and just gaze. They would just gaze at each other. It was just an incredible look at the power of the gaze and of the experience felt with a complete stranger. Even when you know nothing about the other person, there's things that do connect you. There's the sharing of space and the experience together and how much that impacts both her and various people. Mm. It was an incredible look at this recording of the experience of art. And as you said before, it's a very broad definition of art, but I would include this in that. To me, art is looking at something and just kind of discovering more about yourself, more about the world, just getting you to make you think of things in maybe a little bit of a different way. I view poetry, you know, landscape art, obviously, photography. But this experience, this performance art, was a fresh look at the definition that I had never really thought of before. So I would entirely recommend that Marina Abramović, The Artist Is Present on Canopy.
It seems like an art documentary is a sort of ideal way of experiencing a piece of art, like a performance art piece. Because unless you're there in the museum, the only other way of getting what that experience was like is to, I don't know, read an article in an art magazine, which is just sort of clinical and impersonal.
Like, or to listen to a podcast about it.
Or listen to a podcast about it. But I think that with documentary, it really gives you the ability to see the art in action and also to get context on it.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
Yeah, it's not just a still picture. You can see the moving, you know, the reactions. It's not just one frame. It's the whole, as close you can get.
And a large part of the documentary also was when she was basically recruiting models to represent herself in the different stages of, I make it sound like narcissistic. She's not like getting people to represent herself, but that she wants to represent her work through the age, right? Mm-hmm. And she can obviously be in one spot, so she has to hire other people to be. But again, there is a lot of nudity, and there, these are nude models. And even the entrance of the exhibit is two people in the nude standing really close together, probably like a foot apart from each other. And you have to pass between them and brush against their bodies to get into the exhibit. And so to me, it was like almost like a cleansing. Like, you have to leave everything behind that makes you uncomfortable and just be open to doing this. And it's just little things like that that really kind of made me open my eyes about, like, she wanted you to help prepare you and get you down to the, like, flay everything off that might not help you. But when she was recruiting these models, she invited them to her home in the Hudson River Valley, and it was 3 days of fasting. You know, she required them to basically go what she would go through to prepare herself, and she kind of invited them to become, she was teaching the next generation of performance artists, essentially.
Did they show how the public reacted to it? I remember that whole, like, what you were saying about the gaze. I remember that being big. Like, I thought that went viral because I remember that video, like, seeing it on YouTube and stuff like that. And did they show, like, the audience reaction? Because I remember, like, there were people who cried and some people who just laughed spontaneously.
Some of the more impactful moments are just clip after clip after clip after clip of people sitting there. They could stay in there, I guess, for as long as they wanted to until, like, towards the end, and they had a 15-minute time limit. But during the movie, you're never sure when the cut is going to end. And it's like various lengths of time. But there's some people with tears streaming down their eyes. There's some people who put their hand over their heart. You know, part of the rules were you could not approach her or touch her or make any gesture towards her. But they were able to express themselves to her. And there's some very impactful moments where her former partner comes and sits down across from her, and like, in those moments she reacts and she'll like reach across. It's just, I won't spoil anything, but it's a really neat moment. But the people were impacted, and people would just come in and sit in that gallery, even if they weren't sitting in front of her. They would be on the sidelines, and some people would just come day after day after day after day watching this happen. They were so fascinated by just these people staring at each other and so much being said without anything being said.
I don't remember exactly the artist, but I know there was some other exhibit that was similar, you know, not staring, but it was to do with like Sleeping Beauty, where like a woman was, she had her eyes closed and different people would approach and they would kiss her. And I guess they had to sign an agreement beforehand saying that if she woke up, quote unquote, after you got kissed, that you'd have to marry her. So it just that kind of reminds me, you know, with the, you know, the hand touching or whatever, it just in that performance art, you experience it.
I think Shia LaBeouf did something similar too. So like he had an exhibit called like I Am Sorry, where he sat in a room and he invited people to join him, and he would have like a prop or something, but they could interact with him in any kind of way, and he was totally silent. And I think sometimes he had like, I remember he had like a bag on his head that said like hashtag I Am Sorry. And it was like right after he had like a plagiarism incident. So it was kind of him poking fun and creating like an art piece of himself. But the way people interacted with him, it was like a critique on our society and kind of like the way you react to, like, when you're given the floor, what you would do.
Yeah, I think that a lot of the power of some of these performance art pieces comes from the interaction between the audience and the artist. With a lot of other types of art, you know, the artist is absent. And so you can say whatever you want to the painting, but if the artist is right there, then you have to sort of think about, you know, your body language and how you are perceived to others. That's a powerful thing for art to do.
Well, there's just the question of presence. You know, going to a saying of one of the best abilities to have is availability. You know, it just speaks to the idea of just being ready and able to be present and to interact. And the presence versus the absence is a really interesting divide to explore.
And you saw that on Canopy?
I did, yep.
Okay. Yeah, Canopy is a great service that we have here at the library. As you mentioned, it's free to anyone who has got a Des Plaines library card. And it's a streaming video service, and a lot of what they have is art documentaries. So actually what I saw is also an art documentary that can be seen on Canopy. I think we've also got a DVD of both of these films in our DVD collection. But I think that it's a pretty interesting sort of comparison and contrast piece with the Abramovich documentary. It's called Maurizio Catalan, Be Right Back, Profile of a Subversive Artist. Hmm. And there are some similarities between the two films because they're both about these kind of provocative performance artists looking back on their career on the occasion of a career retrospective exhibit at a prestigious museum. The comparison sort of ends there because even though they both kind of use some of the same techniques, I think a big part of Abramovich's theme as an artist is like using your own body, especially in the pieces that involve like self-harm or, you know, violence, implied violence. Maurizio Catalan does something similar, but he's never the person sort of in peril. He'll remove himself from the artwork wherever possible. So one of his pieces was he duct taped his art dealer to the wall and sort of left him there until he passed out. So that's what we're dealing with. We're dealing with an artist who's provocative, but also has sort of an arch, wry sense of humor. And someone at the very beginning of the documentary says, he's either one of the best living artists or one of the worst. There's no middle ground with this guy. Actually, sometimes this documentary feels like a mockumentary because some of the things that he's put out there as art are just kind of ridiculous. At one point, somebody says his next couple works were about avoiding work. And so the title of the film, Be Right Back, refers to one of his early pieces where he got an exhibition in Italy, and he basically took the gallery, closed the door, put a lock on the door, and put up a sign saying, Be Right Back, and invited people to come and look at the sign. I think that a lot of the ideas that he explores are similar to the negative preconceptions that some people have about conceptual art and performance art. I think that there's a lot of skepticism popularly around, you know, pieces of art where it's a happening instead of a tangible thing. And a lot of times the target of his art is like a critique of the art world and what you can get away with in the art world. So it shows one of his first pieces as being a mocked up fake issue of a, at the time, very influential art criticism magazine. He just made fake versions with his own artwork on the front cover and placed them in bookshops around Italy. And, of course, some people got mad about that, but it started to make a name for him. So, yeah, I think that the My Kid Could Paint That effect of some elements of modern art are what he's sort of commenting on here, where a lot of the ideas behind them are, if anything, they're just sort of a prank on the art world. And so when he does get the chance to have a career retrospective exhibit at the Guggenheim, he decides to get all of his previous works back from their public or private owners and to suspend them from the ceiling. At one point, the curator at the Guggenheim says, just before their opening, like, I'm so nervous that I did the math wrong and that the roof would cave in. And the impression that I get is that Maurizio Catalan is the kind of guy who would have loved that. He would have loved if the museum got severely damaged as a part of this artwork. It's mostly conceptual art that he does, but he also has a fascination with hyperrealism. And again, this is a bit of craftsmanship, but it's not his craftsmanship. So he will hire someone who makes wax figurines to make a life-sized, very realistic life-size figurine of a, you know, a very culturally recognizable figure like the Pope or Hitler, and will put them in a strange, off-putting, and kind of controversial setting. So there was a life-sized Pope John Paul, and he was hit by an asteroid, and there was broken glass around. That was very controversial, especially in Italy. Another piece was a figure of Adolf Hitler, but in prayer, on his knees, sort of supplicated. Also, obviously, a very controversial figure, and not many easy answers in these, but they sort of provoke the viewer in different ways. But I should also mention that it's a very funny movie because, you know, a lot of it is provocation, and he's sort of gleeful anytime someone takes the bait. Another one of his artworks was wax figures of children hanging from a tree in a public park. And obviously that's an upsetting visual, especially since it wasn't in a museum, it was a public work. And someone was so offended by it and horrified that he actually climbed the tree and started cutting the kids down, fell, and was injured in the process, and woke up in the hospital and was arrested for defacing public art.
Well, I think it's funny because it almost sounds like, even though, like you said, like he hired someone else to create the wax figurines.
Yeah.
Or
taxidermists. He's very big into taxidermy as well.
But I think it's interesting. So it's almost like his mind is the art itself.
Yeah.
Because it's like he's the one doing the juxtaposition and saying this is putting it together to say a certain thing.
Yeah. Like the actual physical object isn't necessarily the art. Like the idea is the art, but the figure, the actual tangible work that you could buy at an auction for hundreds of thousands of dollars, that's not quite the artwork. Like the artwork is the idea of it.
Beyond the frame.
Yes.
There you go. That's a good beyond the frame. Yeah, it's interesting that he is detached, you know, as compared to what Joel was talking about with the artist. It was, she was so involved with her work, but with this one, you know, he's detached and is almost like his own viewer of the art, seeing how it plays out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting, too, because it's almost like he's not taking, I think by removing himself in that kind of way, he's not taking his art too seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's almost saying, like, this is my art, but it's also a joke. And then, like you said, like, if the art pieces were to collapse, he would have found that hysterical.
Right. Or that someone trying to intervene in his own art got injured in the process. I'm sure he thinks that that is part of the art, not a planned part. But like that's now a piece of what that art is about. Or another example is he invited several influential names in the modern art world to basically a garbage dump in Palermo and had cocktails and put a life-size replica of the Hollywood sign above them. But really, they were just hanging out in a garbage dump. So what's the art there? Is it the people who were invited mingling and having a reception at, in a dump? Was it the garbage? Was it the Hollywoodland sign in the background?
Hmm.
So yeah, I would recommend this to anyone who would go to a museum and, you know, look at a banana duct taped to the wall and really consider the implications of that. Anyone who likes sort of the controversial side of art and the question of, is this art in the first place?
Hmm.
I think you'd get a lot out of the documentary.
I guess I can go.
Yes.
So, I did not watch a documentary or anything, but I figured maybe I would kind of talk about what is versus is not art. I thought that was kind of interesting because we here at the Des Plaines Public Library have a circulating art collection, if you guys didn't know, which can be found on the third floor. And I remember when we were first promoting that collection again and cataloging it, a lot of the staff ended up taking a piece and putting it at their desk or putting it up. And a lot of it is local Des Plaines artists. And it was just very funny to see what people chose to kind of put up versus what they didn't. And so I just wanted to kind of talk about that because I moved a few months ago. And so myself and my old roommates, we used to paint together just for fun. And then when I moved in recently with my boyfriend, he said, you know, like the art that we painted will go in our back room and it won't be presented in the main room and where people will actually see these things. And so I just thought it was kind of interesting, like how subjective that is. Or like I've seen a lot of art exhibits. Like I went to the Takashi Murakami exhibit when it was at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago a few years ago. I went to the Andy Warhol exhibit at the Art Institute. And I remember I went there with my mom and I remember my sister and I were also there and we were looking at it. We really liked it. And then I looked at my mom. I was like, oh, what do you think of this exhibit? And she's like, you know, I don't really like Andy Warhol. I'm not a big fan. but then we went to Monet and she was, you know, like kind of drooling over Monet. So I just kind of wanted to comment on like how interesting I found it of what people find is art versus is not art.
Yeah.
Or even some people, like you were saying, like if you didn't like make the art yourself, they don't necessarily consider it art or they don't call themselves like real artists. Like I think of, and I don't know if this would be, this is more kind of music, but I listened to a lot of The Lonely Island when I was younger. And they're like these three guys who they do like mock rap songs. And they always call themselves fake rappers. And I was like, but you are a rapper. Like, I mean, you like created the rap song and you are doing it. Or like I think of, I have a calendar up in my workspace called Social Justice Kittens. And it's this artist, John Tijerachi. He has a book called Liar Town USA, which we don't have here at the library just because There were some things that were a little saucy in it. But he does a lot of like satire. So like with the calendar at my desk, it's a picture of a kitten, and then he'll have like a quote, like usually a pretty liberal quote. And it does kind of look at like the ridiculous of it. Like there's a kitten on, and then on it, it has a quote that says like, "I drink the tears of my oppressors," or something. And it is an actual quote from someone. But and it's funny because it's like no matter where you stand on the political spectrum, you still kind of laugh at it and just say like, oh, this is an interesting satire on kind of where we are.
Yeah, an interesting juxtaposition of like the cute kitten. And
yeah,
the...
or like there's puppies on there too in the actual calendar. And one says, "I know I'm a puppy and I'm sorry I'm a puppy." And it's interesting. So it's kind of whatever you take of it. And yeah, no matter where you stand, it is just funny. But it's almost kind of like he splices these two pieces of art and makes it into something with his vision and his mind.
Yeah, it's a shame we don't have that Liartown book. I really liked his, I think he posted stuff on Tumblr for a while.
Mm-hmm. He had a bunch of zines that he started off with in the 80s that he called Crap Hound.
Mm.
And that was kind of how he got his start because he didn't have the money to have like a big gallery exhibit or really the notoriety either. Mm. And so he would self-publish these zines, which then got put out. And if you guys aren't aware of zines, it's oftentimes like from writers, and they put together like pieces of art to create something, which I think also here we have like an online resource for like crafters called Creative Book. And I think they have a video on how to create a zine or people who want to get into zines. So if that's something you're interested in, I would definitely watch the video as well.
Yeah, that brings up a good point. We've got a lot of databases that are available from our website that you can use to experience art or to learn how to, you know, make your own. So we've got, as you mentioned, Creative Bug. There's Artist Works, which has sort of guided tutorials from respected artists. There's the aforementioned Canopy with all of those documentaries.
Mm-hmm. You know, we got Biography and Context, you know, for just a general information on some artists.
Yeah, just for like an overview. And it also has like articles and interviews as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And all of that can be found from the resources tab of our website, dppl.org. So make sure you check that out as well.
And there's also, Ariana was talking about the art in the library. I know there's a section on the website that actually shows the large installations and the artists and kind of what it means to the library. You can check that out too.
Yeah, we've got plenty of cool installations. Like I'm sure everyone who's been to the library remembers the books and pages and letters hanging from the ceiling, that installation. I forgot the name of the work.
Skywards.
Skywards.
W-O-R-D-S.
It's just so visually arresting going up the stairs every time. It just kind of reminds you that, you know, you're surrounded by art.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like here in Des Plaines, too, because I've worked at other libraries, and I feel like we put a lot of art on display.
Yeah, a lot
even
of murals.
Just like the murals that you can find on our website as well, or even there's like a statue on the fourth floor that you can see on like sculpture art up there, as well as we have some local art from local artists on the wall, I think on the third floor and
through the
fourth
floor. Des Plaines Art Guild.
So I think we're very much incorporated in that, and we've done things where I think we're going to actually have like a chalk art exhibit. We're going to have a local artist come and actually draw something outside of our library.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. I know that at least one of my neighbors in Des Plaines has super great chalk art skills. I found this on, you know, pandemic walks last year. Just two blocks away from me, there's someone who has multicolored chalk and a lot of talent.
I know. It's interesting, the artistic response, what people have created during the pandemic. Mm. We actually have an exhibit on the first floor right now of the kids and teenagers in District 62, where they've created, like on little postcards, their response to the pandemic in art. And it's interesting to see because some are very positive, like, oh, like I get to take walks with my family. Mm-hmm. But then there's one where I think it just says like boredom or you know, it's just like, it's really fascinating.
No
to
jet
see.
Travel.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And that's called 6 Feet Up Art.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. And that, up art.
And if you don't catch it in real life, it'll be documented on Des Plaines Memory.
All right. Michelle, would you like to go next?
Yeah. So I guess I'll just preface. I watched a DVD. It's called The Story of Women in Art. The narrator is historian Amanda Vickery. And it was interesting because to preface why I was interested in this is I took an AP art history course in high school. And there was like this painting that we were studying, and it was by a female artist called Berthe Morisot. She was a 19th century impressionist painter. And I remember she's like, oh, she's not going to be on the test. Don't even worry about her. Like, kind of like wrote her off entirely. And I was like, I wonder why, you know, like I felt her painting was really good and it was neat. And I, you know, just learned, you know, just how little like historical women artists have been represented in different art books or even art museums. Mm. And so this documentary goes all the way back to the 1500s, where she was able to find these female artists who were actually pretty successful. The first one that she really kind of goes into depth is an artist called Sofonisba Anguissola. She was an Italian artist, and she actually, her father had asked Michelangelo if she could copy one of his drawings. Hmm. And Michelangelo acquiesced the request, and, you know, he was actually pretty impressed with her copy of the drawing. And she was later discovered by Philip II of Spain, and she became a court painter. So she was able to establish this really, you know, good success, so much so that later on in life, the Flemish Anthony van Dyck, he was impressed and he was almost like copying her and, you know, was really influenced by her. So I thought that was interesting that, you know, you have this artist that even other artists were, they were looking to her for inspiration and yet not many people have heard about her. I thought that was unique. Another one she talked about was Elizabeth Vigée Le Brun. She's probably most famous for painting Marie Antoinette, the doomed French queen. And she had quite a number of successes other than just painting in France. She actually, during the French Revolution, she went all over Europe. So she went to Italy, Austria, Russia, Prussia, England. She went all over and she was very successful, you know, painting at the different courts and, you know, being able to live a quite a nice lifestyle. And then going back to the Berthe Morisot, I found her story fascinating because she was one of the mainstays of the Impressionist movement. She participated in 7 out of the 8 Impressionist exhibitions, whereas in contrast, someone like Monet or Degas, I think they only participated in like 4 or 5. Mm-hmm. So that was pretty impressive. And she was married to Manet's brother, so she had that sort of connection with Eugene Manet. But the thing about it, looking at her art, she struggled kind of with a lot of women struggle today. She wanted to be a painter. She wanted to follow her career, but she also wanted to have a family. And she didn't know necessarily, like, should she go one way or the other. She was lucky and a bit unusual for the time that she was able to do both, that her husband ended up supporting a lot of her work. So I just found that interesting. I mean, the documentary goes into more than just paintings. They talk about sort of the traditional arts and crafts that were or have been still traditionally devalued because they were more considered women's work or whatnot. And there's a lot of interesting examples. I know there was one who was a paper cutter in the Netherlands that she mentions, and she was actually making almost about as much money as some of the painters were about that time, in that area at least. Mm. So I thought that was interesting that even then she was still valued for her art. It's an interesting documentary, really opens your eyes that, you know, there's more women artists or even other marginalized, you know, different communities that they have been around. It's not like, you know, this is a new phenomenon. Mm-hmm. They have been around. They just, unfortunately, have been kind of forgotten. Mm. So it's a 3-part series. It's on DVD here at the library. But I'd recommend it for anyone interested in overall women artists or just forgotten artists.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, certainly the canon of art, not just in visual art, but like in music and books and you name it, there is this sort of women aren't on the test element.
Right.
The old white guys are, you know, the people in the history books, and then everyone else is maybe a footnote, if that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a tragic situation, and I'm glad that there is a documentary sort of shedding more light on these unknown or lesser-known artists.
Yeah.
So, too, a lot of art, much of what we see is based out of Western ideas of art, like that, you know, when we talk about the old masters and, right. and whatnot, like everyone's just referring to Europe, you know, essentially. Mm-hmm. And then we go to the, you know, the Hudson River School and stuff like that. But I'd be more interested to find out what the rest of the world, you know, art-wise. I've always been fascinated with the Northwestern indigenous cultures, the way that they made their poles and the, you know, they had function. Mm-hmm. They weren't just artwork, but they are like visually arresting.
Yeah.
And the totems of the, like, and they've been appropriated, but I've always wanted to go and learn more about those peoples through viewing what the art, obviously not through my experience, but just like what it meant to them.
Yeah.
And how it was created.
I did watch another documentary on, this was on Canopy. It was about Van Gogh in Japan, about how at that time in France, Japonism, as they called it, or like, you know, really loving Japan art was really popular. So they had all these woodblock prints. And they're talking about how Van Gogh was just so enthralled with this sort of the uniqueness, you know, but yet at the same time, the serial nature, because they would print off hundreds of the same prints. In some of his art in the documentary, it was talking about how when he went to the south of France, how he's like, it looks, you know, just like Japan should. Of course, the south of France doesn't look anything like Japan, but to him, like when he saw the trees or like the sky, and you can see that in some of his painting with more like the flat colors or like, you know, the different close-ups of the flowers. So he was influenced by them, but he kind of turned it into something of his own, which I thought was interesting. Like there's... I don't remember the exact title, but like he actually like copies. There's this woman, a courtesan. She's like dressed in a kimono and a fancy headdress. And he paints her with these very bright, almost garish colors as compared to the original block. But he, around the border of it, he adds his own. It's sort of like these very stereotypical like Japanese plants and other flowers. So it's interesting that it's sort of like a French impressionist view of the woodblock prints. That was interesting.
Yeah.
To hear, you know, because I think that's about the time when Western cultures were a little bit more interested in, you know, expanding their knowledge of different artworks.
I think that is interesting because that reminds me too, I didn't know about Van Gogh in Japan, but I was thinking too, like with the Frank Lloyd Wright houses, they're kind of all over the place, like here in Illinois or Chicago, like they'll have them in Oak Park. I've seen a lot, but then there's a few in Rogers Park as well. And it's just interesting that an artist will be kind of like fixated on this culture and then they'll kind of make a spin of their own, but it is these traditional kind of like European or like American artists that we follow and then they're still borrowing these, which is wonderful to bring it into our culture, but it is kind of interesting that it's, once again, it's kind of like these traditional European or American artists representing something like that.
Right. I know there's some contemporary artists, though, that are gaining some ground. There's one Native American artist. Her name is Joan Quick-to-See Smith, and she does, I forget which tribe she's a part of, but she's a Native American artist, and like a lot of her works have to do with her anger at how the Native Americans were treated. Like in one thing, it's like called The Trade. She has all these newsprints from Native American published journals and she like paints over it. And she has these trinkets from these insensitive racial characters, like from the Cleveland Indians. So she's almost like saying, you know, we traded our land for your beads or fabrics or whatever. Can you give us back our land for these, you know, because we don't want these racial stereotypes. Right. So I thought that was interesting. And then it's sort of like a political commentary, you know, kind of really visualizing it like, you know, this is what happened. Can you, almost asking people, you know, through the artwork, like, can you rectify this now?
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's, I think, more of a start now that, you know, we're more globally thoughtful or whatever. But, yeah.
That's really interesting. Yeah, I think there definitely is. I was even just thinking of the artist who painted the portraits of the Obama family and how beautiful and how that varied. And it's so different from what's been painted in the past of the presidential portraits. And he made a very conscious decision to bring in an African-American artist, and I think that's wonderful.
I think, isn't there a picture book about somebody who saw, like, a girl looking at the portraits? I'm almost positive there's, like, a picture book, because she was inspired by this little girl who was looking at the portraits. She saw someone that kind of looked like her, and she was just so, you know, in awe, and I'm pretty sure there's a picture book.
I'm trying to see if I can find it. Now I'm curious.
Yeah, I'm seeing like a hardcover book of the portraits, but not the...
Parker Looks Up, An Extraordinary Moment.
Yes, yes, that's it. So kind of, you know, seeing how somebody reacts to the art.
Right, and that is like an extension of the art.
Right, right.
Yeah, it was really interesting when watching the Abramovich documentary of, you know, half of it was the art itself, but then the other part was watching people's reaction to it.
Yeah.
The people who turned away, the people who... It was just fascinating. Helped you to relate to the people, and how would you have experienced that same situation?
Right. And when you are confronted with a kind of provocative, confrontational work, what does your reaction say about the work or about yourself?
And with that type of, you know, what does it say about the artists themselves as far as like the stamina and the durability to, for instance, for Abramovich to sit in a chair, doesn't sound like much, to sit in a chair for 9 hours straight
For months at a time.
Right, for three entire months. And you could see the physical wear and tear on her at the end of the day. And when the exhibit ended, there was just a profound sense of relief on her face. But it wasn't just like, oh my gosh, I'm so glad. But it was the finishing of a marathon. You know, it was a sense of completion rather than, oh dear God, let it end. When people perform art or when they create art, and as you, Charlie, you've been parts of many bands, you know, it takes time is also what we're not talking about. Like it takes massive amounts of time beyond the thought and the, you know, it's not a lightning flash and then there's art.
Right. There is a scene in the Abramovich documentary where she says, so much of what I do is administration. Like it's not about creativity or the process. Like most of the process is making phone calls and, you know, faxing and sending emails and making sure the colors are right. And that's something that you don't see often enough. Like there's usually just a finished artwork that you engage with. You don't see behind the scenes what led up to that.
Right. And there's the hours traveling. There's the, I mean, you know, going to other types of art, you know, with, especially with music, there's hours traveling, there's arranging for venues and there's negotiations. And
I wonder if she could do like a documentary or something about the process behind it. You know, I
mean, a lot of it is in that film.
Okay.
They showed part of the exhibit is the truck that she and her partner, Ulay, his name, U-L-A-Y, they were together for 12 years and they lived in this truck and they went around doing their performance art and they lived out of this truck. They would just, and there's many, many pictures of them sitting in the countrysides outside of the truck at the end of the day or, you know, driving or doing stuff. They do their laundry at a laundromat or whatever. And they were on the road constantly and he would be fixing the truck and she'd be doing laundry. And then they had the actual truck at the exhibit. And then they presented, they had apparently not seen it until that moment. So it's like very presenting it individually, one at a time, it recorded their reaction to those memories of being on the road and of the time. There was a point where she could hardly talk. She was so caught up in the emotion. So,
and yeah, putting that in the exhibit sort of implies that even if they didn't think of it as art at the time, that real life is still art in a way.
I think it's, that was a big part of her thing is like when you're in a relationship with someone, there is the art of negotiation. There is the art of conflict. There is the art of how to react to somebody, how to treat somebody. It's a delicate touch, not a delicate touch per se, but like a very...
It's certainly not a delicate touch if you're running into one another at full speed.
See, that's the edge point where, you know, sometimes when you're in an argument with someone, that's basically what you're doing. You know, words can impact like that. Sometimes when things are, you know, in a conversation or in a heated discussion, you know, words come fast and heavy. And sometimes you maybe say something you wouldn't have said. And it causes the pain that you would rather not be there. So that's what I would take out of the performance art. It was just like an introspection of how do I act? How, what does this represent? What's he trying to say?
And yeah, there's not one meaning that you can derive from really any of these works. You know, what gives them power is that they're open-ended and that anyone can bring their own personal experience and sort of view it through their own worldview.
And that's part of, like, if you're looking for answers, exploring art is not for you. I mean, in a way, it kind of is.
Well, yeah,
but
it could be.
It could be, but really, a large part of art is discovering, like, the undefinable. And capturing the undefinable and somehow putting definition to it, but it really doesn't have answers, but it has, it might lead you down a different path.
Right. It's communication, but not like just sitting with unbroken eye contact. It's communication, but it's not verbal. It's not something that you can easily communicate to someone else, but it's a real thing that's there.
Yeah, sometimes it asks more questions when you look at it. You know, you start questioning even more.
Right.
But like you're saying, you know, those questions can lead you down a path towards the answer.
It's a classic journey is the whole thing. There's not the destination. If you ever find the answer, I mean, in my personal opinion, I think when you find the answer, it's it. Life is like, you know, it's at the end of your life, really, you know, because you're, there's always more to go on. But maybe I'm getting too philosophical, but...
No, I think that's what art at its best does. It sort of turns us all into philosophers.
I saw a quote recently from... It was attributed to Plato, but
It was also through the internet, so sometimes they can get Aristotle or Plato, or even Leonardo da Vinci all confused. But the quote is regarding poetry, but it said poetry has more truth to it than history. Mm. You know, paraphrasing. But yeah. That's, to me, history, I'm learning more and more, being a lover of history, that it is one of the most not true things mm-hmm. you can experience. Mm.
What's so funny, I mean, just like all of it's so up to interpretation. So your talk kind of like history is kind of, this is the way it's written. And so this probably happened, especially when it's something like more like the history books that you're kind of taught in school and stuff like that. But like you said, like as you're finding out, like more of it is, it's just a continuous story. And that can almost be said about art too. Like I even think of my friend who was an art major in college. And one time I think someone she didn't know came over to her place, like one of her roommate's friends. And he looked through her portfolio and he started telling her every single thing that he interpreted about her art. Later on, like he asked her, he's like, oh, was I right at all? And she's like, not at all. But she, like, it opened her eyes to it. And she liked that he was able to acquire something else from it. And that it is a continuous story. And that she, too, is finding out something different about her own art that she didn't think of in the beginning.
Mm-hmm. My grandfather was an artist. And we have a lot of his works up in my house. And it's really nice to hear my dad's interpretation. Like he'll point to a watercolor and say, oh, I helped him. It's an abstract watercolor. I helped him name that, you know, and he asked me what I should name it and I, whatever. But one of them is a really interesting piece. It's in a white frame. And it's just it's a rectangle of wood. It's finished, but it has like a natural wood fissure in it. And my grandfather labeled it it was part of his series he had. First nature, then man, or something along the lines of that. First by nature, then by man. Basically, man took this natural piece of wood with a natural fissure in it and crafted it into a rectangle and polished it up and sheened it. But the thing about it is, it's in a prominent place in my house, and I find myself staring at it off and on. Like, what else did, like, what's behind this? What did he mean by this? And he passed, you know, a couple decades ago. I feel like I'm getting, the more I understand the artwork of his, the more I can understand more about him and by extension me, you know, like where I've come from or where he was coming from, and I'm related to him. And so I think that art not only is it very universal and it has like a lot of different interpretations, a lot of different people, but it also has a very personal connection. As you alluded to, one person might completely think of it 180 degrees away from what someone else interpreted. And I think that's maybe the pain, but also the beauty of art, that everyone has their own, not only just story to tell, but their own interpretation and their own opinion about it.
And they're all valid.
Mm-hmm. Yes. There's no wrong answer. So not only are there no answers, there's no wrong answers.
Yeah. Art is very emotional. Mm. You know, and I think that's what you kind of mean about how the poetry, it's more history than history itself, is because you're connecting with people on that emotional level. You kind of are able to experience what they're feeling inside. And that's kind of what art does. You know, even like you're saying, even if it isn't quite the same emotions, it's still, you're still experiencing kind of these shared universal emotions.
Yeah.
It's a basic level of humanity.
Right.
That is being touched. So there are people who would say, question, getting back to Ariana's question, is it art? Is it not art? Is there anything that is not art?
If it doesn't have a frame around it.
Like, suppose someone recently cut a lawn, like you walk through it and then you tracked in some grass clippings. Mm-hmm. Would that be art if you looked at it on the floor?
If you say it is.
I'm just wondering. Like,
yeah,
what,
no, it's
like,
whatever you want to define art. So yeah, in a sense that in certain people's minds, yeah, nothing is not art. Double negative there.
Because you might not call it art yourself. So some people might argue that it's the intention behind the art, but whose intention is it either? You know what I mean? Like, because you may have tracked this in and then you would see it and you're like, oh, this is just grass and dirt on my floor. But then I think I recently came back from a vacation. We were staying with a couple who had a 3-year-old kid and we went to the ocean and we're sitting there on the beach and she's just playing with the sand, or she's just doing things that her imagination is running wild, and she sees things out of objects that we never would have seen ourselves. Mm. So it's like whose intention and whose perspective is the art?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There is a film that I alluded to the title of earlier, but there's a movie called My Kid Could Paint That, another art documentary that came out maybe 15 years ago or so. I'm not sure if it's in our collection, but it's quite good. I saw it several years ago, and it's about, I think, a 3-year-old abstract artist. You know, she sort of goes viral after some local human interest stories on the news would say, you know, look at this four-year-old girl who's fetching hundreds of thousands of dollars at auction houses. And, of course, the pushback to that is, my kid paints and we put it on the refrigerator, but we don't think she's the next Picasso. And because the art world had sort of taken on her work as something to take seriously, it raised the question of, when are you a proper artist? Is it her intent or is it her parents' intent? Are her parents acting as like the stage parents, sort of foisting her on the stage when she's just having fun with a canvas? And of course, the film doesn't answer any of those questions, but it raises them.
Mm-hmm. That is interesting. I mean, I don't know. Like, should we, because then that's a whole other ballpark. Because one would say, almost kind of like Joel was saying, where it's like, it's when you have the answers that the ending comes. So it's like, it's setting those limits on things that I think almost say, not that it's saying that it's not art necessarily, but it's saying that it can't reach the potential that it can. Or, you know, I mean, this is, you don't want to ever put limits on something. So I think you're right about the stage parents, but sometimes it is just being in the right place at the right time. Like, I even think of all these artists who spent their whole life making art or in some capacity where it was similar to these other ones. And it's just, a lot of it is kind of right place, right time, who you know, or not stopping yourself or putting any kind of limits on it.
And, you know, the instinct to art, I think, is just sort of a human thing. People like creating. It feels good when you make something. Mm-hmm. I think that with the artist in My Kid Could Paint That, it's the same impulse as you would have, like, if you're playing with a coloring book. But since her parents gave her oil paints and a canvas, then that sort of puts it into a different realm. Or does it?
And then it leads to the question about the art, like, well, kind of what gave them the authority to pick and choose what's good and what isn't, you know, because everybody's tastes are different.
Yeah.
So it's interesting questions about that.
Yeah.
You know?
And what's the line?
Right.
Where do you cross the line? Mm-hmm. Maybe another Maurizio Catalan piece would be good to drop in here. He once had an exhibit where he broke into a museum across the street and stole another artist's exhibition and put it in his own. And was arrested in the process of it. So whose art is that? Is it a shared artwork? Is the idea of theft enough to make that a different work of art?
Mm. Yeah, that's starting to get into performance art
territory. Yeah, it is.
Or is that just being a jerk?
Well, maybe both.
There is an argument to be made for that.
Yeah.
It's hard, because I also think of, I guess we can tie it into art, but I think of this one hacker. He had like applied for a job at a bank, and he had said, here, I got all these people's information that I got just from hacking, and this is why you need more security, and this is why you should hire me. And I can't remember, maybe it was a bank or maybe it was like Google or something. But instead, someone did get hired that way, but another person had tried the same thing, and they got arrested. So it's kind of like, where is it art, or where is it a performance piece, versus where is it taking a step too far and making it illegal?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like, where does the boundary of law fit on top of art? Is, like, art above law?
I mean, does it go back to intention? Or,
right.
Because couldn't someone just lie?
Mm-hmm.
Not to sound anarchist or anything.
Well, like, no, there's a lot of art that's just kind of openly, proudly controversial and provocative. A lot of it does seem to be trying to find where that line is and what's a transgression of societal norms, and even if it is a transgressive, is it still okay?
That's the thing about lines. No one really recognizes it until you, like, go over it.
Yeah.
You know, you don't just say, oh, there's the line over there, but we're still on this side of it. Mm-hmm. You know, usually only recognize it when you're way over.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the sort of debate about graffiti art.
Mm, yeah.
You know, like, some people are like, well, it's an expression. Other people are like, nope, it defaces things.
Private property.
Yeah, it's, you know, there's, what side of the line is it? You know, is it tottering on the line or, you know, you just question that.
One of the highlights of going into, I grew up outside of Philadelphia, we'd go for field trips and we'd go down the Conshohocken Freeway, and I just love looking at all the graffiti all over the brick walls, and there's like train stations there, and there's like a bridge with a bunch of brick facing that. It was just gorgeous.
Mm.
I loved it. That was like a highlight of my trip. Whenever we go into Philadelphia, I'd like that.
Yeah, maybe graffiti just needs to have a different name, like non-commissioned public art.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there you go. Then sometimes that's what it takes. You know, it's all about the word choice. And then, you know, people might be more on board.
Yeah.
I mean, a surprise mural.
Yeah. There you go.
That's what it is. I mean, if you're at a train station, it's almost like a captive audience.
Yeah.
You see the trains go by and you're like, whoa, that was really good.
Yeah. I'd rather see that than, you know, billboards and advertisements.
Right.
I think that's the whole point, is that some, you know, it's subversive. You know, they're like, well, if you can post this thing about, you know, calling Geico or getting my hair back, you know, why can't I put something, you know, that means something to me or my community instead?
Mm. Yeah.
So obviously there's people who call the shots and then there's artists. In a sense, right? Because we were just talking about like who gets to decide, like the art dealers,
right?
Advertising, they call shots, you know, so it's an interesting divide.
Yeah. And here at the Des Plaines Public Library, we don't have the answers, but we've got all the questions. We've got so much that you can check out, that you can view, that you can take home with you, that will bring some of these questions to your mind and provoke thought and provoke a different way of thinking. Mm-hmm. So view some art, make some art, go forth and create. All right, that'll do it for this episode. Thanks for joining us, and we will see you next time.